dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1 FM, or Free Radio Olympia 91.3. I'd like to send messages of solidarity to Free Radio Santa Cruz 101.1, which was raided and shut down by federal officials last week. Free Radio Santa Cruz is presently streaming on the web at www.freakradio.org, and I wish them a speedy return to the airwaves of this supposedly free country, as I wish the same to another fine radio station, Knoxville First Amendment Radio, KFAR, similarly raided earlier last month. These stations were nominally shut down due to their lack of a government-issued license to broadcast. I say nominally because the whole system of licensure is designed to appear to be content neutral, but in fact favors allocation of radio spectrum to those who use the spectrum as a vehicle for commercial activity, and thus will not challenge America's democracy, $1, one vote, which guarantees that the prevailing corporate project of empire will not be confronted or questioned. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. This week, we bring you the first part of the 9/11 Citizens Commission, which held a day-long hearing in New York City on September 9th. We go now to Kyle Hentz of 911truth.org as he introduces the hearing.
Ladies and gentlemen, New Yorkers, fellow Americans, and concerned citizens from around the world, welcome to the first hearings of the 9/11 Citizens Commission, who some have dubbed the omission hearings. We are present here today to say that we, the people, will be heard, and that neither courageous whistleblowers nor unflinching investigative journalists will be silenced or intimidated by the pomp and circumstance of a deeply compromised 9/11 commission, the one commissioned by our government, after much, much pressure was put on by family members and other concerned citizens. The Bush administration obstructed and did not want to launch an investigation into the attacks. And when they did, the Congress only allotted $3 million. Until, again, public pressure, family member pressure, raised the budget, and eventually they were granted $15 million, which is still a pittance compared to what they invested in the Challenger shuttle disaster. I think they spent $50 million. 3 years ago, the world was transfixed when, in the course of an hour and 20 minutes, four aircraft were employed as weapons to murder nearly 3,000 people from scores of countries around the world. We must ask ourselves and our leaders how we can maintain that ours is a government of, by, and for a free people when a panel commissioned to investigate 9/11 does not answer a majority of the questions posed by victim family members and others. When nearly 400 questions were posed by the families over the course of 2 years, and nowhere were they directly answered by a government-appointed panel. After fighting the administration, who did not want to investigate, and lobbying hard on Capitol Hill. The commission was charged with a dual mandate to provide recommendations to make us safer on one hand, but to also provide us a full accounting of the facts and circumstances. We are here to raise questions and doubt about their accounting of the events and the facts and circumstances surrounding the attacks. These are facts and circumstances that Bob McElveen, one of our commissioners, wants to have answers to, wants to be further scrutinized. For their wives, husbands, brothers, sisters, mothers, and fathers, the victim family members, they perished on 9/11. We are here to right this wrong, this travesty of justice, and begin to redress the bodies of evidence too long ignored that will help us to begin to answer the questions and help place pressure on the government to reopen the investigation, to answer the questions and the issues that the 9/11 Commission has either ignored or failed to address completely. It is vitally important to note that not only hasn't the alleged primary culprit not been brought to justice, but neither has a single co-conspirator been successfully prosecuted in nearly 3 years since 9/11. Not one single co-conspirator has been successfully brought to justice through our court system and charged with complicity in 9/11. And yet, in the wake of the attacks, not a single government official in a position of responsibility at the time of 9/11 has been held accountable in any way. In fact, what you have instead is people in positions of responsibility getting promotions and rewards in the wake of the attacks. We have an intense and full program of hearings planned today. In 6 hours, we cannot possibly begin to address everything that has been brought forward by different researchers, investigative journalists, and family members. But we can begin to touch upon that which has not been addressed by the Cain Commission. We can begin to frame the key questions and the body of evidence that suggests perhaps a wider circle of complicity. The Zogby poll, commissioned by 9/11 Citizens Watch and 9/11truth.org, found that nearly 50%, nearly half of New Yorkers polled, believe that the administration or some leaders, with this particular wording, had specific knowledge of an attack imminent on or around September 11th and consciously failed, these were the words in the question, to take action. 66% of those polled in New York City believe that the investigation should be reopened by Congress or by the Attorney General of New York State, Eliot Spitzer. And what I'd like to do now, before I introduce our commissioners briefly for their opening statements, I'd like to ask that we observe a moment of silence, and that for those who perished on 9/11 and in the wars and violence since. So let us proceed with a moment of silence and prayer, if you wish, before we begin our first hearing. And I'd like to begin with these words: not by power, not by money, but by thy spirit. Thank you. So let me move on and introduce the commissioners that we do have here. We have Dr. Faz Khan at the far end of the table. He's an American Muslim of Indian and Afghani descent. He is a doctor, an MD, emergency physician, and internist here in New York City. On 9/11, he was on duty and treated victims at a triage center. And worked with rescue teams. He's active in the peace movement. He's a lecturer and writer on various issues related to Islam. He is an assistant imam at various New York and Long Island mosques, and was a delegate on the Baghdad Peace Belt pilgrimage went to Baghdad the week before the war began. And then Bob McElvain, very briefly, and he can say a little bit more if you'd like. But Bob, we're honored to have Bob here on the panel. As some of you, most of you are probably aware, there was not a family member on the 9/11 Commission. At one point it was discussed, but in the end it was made up primarily of conflicted insiders from inside the Beltway. So Bob McElvain lost his son Bobby, who was working and presenting on a business day in North Tower. And then we have our chair, today's chair, future co-chair of today's hearing, Cynthia McKinney. I'm sure most of you are familiar with her extraordinary record in Congress, standing up in the voice of the people, five-term congresswoman who recently won her primary and is working to regain her seat in Congress. So let me turn it over to Cynthia and the commissioners, and then after they've made brief introductory remarks, we're going to show an edited portion of testimony provided by Mindy Kleinberg of the 9/11 Family Steering Committee that she made before the 9/11 Commission on the first day of hearings, March 31st of last year, down at the Customs House in Manhattan. Let me turn it over to Cynthia. Cynthia, please.
Thank you, Kyle. I would like to take this opportunity to thank 911 Truth and Citizens Watch for having this important hearing today. I'd like to also take the time to thank Commissioner Khan, as well as Commissioner McIlvain, for agreeing to serve with me on this very important commission. I would also like to mention another commissioner who couldn't be with us today, but whose commitment we all know, and that is Catherine Austin Fitz. Today is just the beginning. Your support can ensure that we follow up with more of these hearings to flesh out all the remaining questions that experts and family members know have not been fully addressed by the official 911 commission or the Bush administration. A special thanks to the small coterie of friends who kept my questions relevant by their own deep understanding of the fundamental danger posed by today's forces, known and unknown, operating in our name at this time. Those thanks especially include the dedicated leaders of the 9/11 Truth Movement, whose work has spawned similar gatherings this week all over our country. For me personally, it means the thousands of people I've had the opportunity to meet who are not just against everything, but who are in the deepest sense pro-America. Finally, I'm serving on a commission where it's all right to ask questions. Now, I know that I intend to ask a whole bunch of questions, and I hope you do too, because we've got the experts here who have studied this tragedy and know its details backward and forward. Hurricane Frances stormed into Florida and, to a lesser extent, my state of Georgia, and left the cleanup to us. Well, the Republican Party stormed into New York City, their words dripping with the politicization of an American tragedy, and they've left the cleanup to us. Now, I don't mind being part of the cleanup crew, but here we operate under a different set of rules. First, our minds in this place are open. Facts are welcome in this place. We have no political agenda other than the truth. On one of my previous trips to New York City, I was given a beautiful poster entitled, "Truth Crushed to the Ground Will Rise Again." Today and into tonight, we will explore the truth of 911. The truth about America's tragedy belongs to all of us and can only be crushed to the ground for so long. The work of this commission, our expert panelists, and our audience will ensure that the truth of 911 will rise one day. I look forward to the intense learning about to take place during these presentations of our esteemed panelists. And now we will hear from our commissioner, Mr. McIlvain, Commissioner McIlvain, and Commissioner Khan.
My name is Bob McIlvain. I'm from Orland, Pennsylvania. I lost my son. When I did this at a press, I wasn't able to get through it, but maybe the second time around. I lost my son at Merrill Lynch. Can't do it. And it's not just because it's 9/11 now, it's just, remember when I speak it happens. But it brings the cold reality to the whole thing. There's a lot of people dying in the world. And we're talking horrible deaths. The deaths of those people down there were horrible. To this day, I just had a discussion with, I'm sorry, I forget your name, but I'm still trying to find out what happened to him. I want to know to that last second what happened to him. Every parent wants to know that. I've run into a lot of parents in, you know, my neighborhood have lost children. And you just want to know that last second, what horror that your child was going through. And I think about it every day. And it rips me apart. And to do this, it truly is a double-edged sword, because I really would, many days, I want to go to an island and just sit there the rest of my life, ignore the rest of the world. And as my son said yesterday, he said, "Why don't you be happy? Try to be happy." Well, it's impossible to be happy. I have happy moments. The suffering isn't as bad. but the pain is still very immense. It's always there. And when you do something like that, it brings you right back to day one. Day one I have every day of my life. I've made that choice. It's been a wonderful journey. And I do it for my son because he really believed that knowledge is power. And if anything you get out of this, it's knowledge. And you have to take it out to the people, out to the American public. That's the only way we can do this. The people of this country must realize what the truth is. And history is replete with so many lies. And they continue day in, day out. And it's just not this Bush administration, it's every administration.
That's right.
And trust me, I'm not an authority up here. All these other people are great authorities. This is a learning process for me. I've made every commission meeting. I've been involved with the widows. I mean, they've done tremendous work. What they've done, the fact that this is out in the public, it would have been an impossibility. Just don't forget, George Bush never wanted this commission. We would have had Kissinger as the head of the commission if it wasn't for the widows. They went to him and said to him, didn't you have some dealings with the bin Ladens in your past? And with that, he quit the commission. Yet we would have had him. So it's just so important that you take a lot out of this and take it out there onto the streets. Because I just deal with the people, dealing with my relatives, dealing with my people in my neighborhood, they still look at it and say, well, I still want to be safe. No one wants to lose their life. And they look at the president and say, well, he's our protector. Our military is our protector. Well, but the thing is, this is the way it is. If you're raising a family and you have three kids, all you want to know is you're protected. And I'm not saying that this is right. I'm just saying is it's so difficult to get to people to explain to them, where do I start? Do I start in Iran in 53 or do I go into the Congo in 60?
Right, exactly.
It's a constant thing, but it's an education. And I don't know, I think there's a lot of people, it's a lost cause in this country. That's why we have to get out to the students of the world. And they have to understand where this all comes from. It's connecting the dots. My son didn't die just because George Bush wasn't inattentive. It has a lot to do with Clinton. It has a lot to do with Bush. It goes all the way back to Eisenhower.
Yes.
Okay, so
that's
I just...
Right.
And this is the legacy of my son. If I would have died in those towers, he'd be doing the same thing. He wants to know the truth. I want to know the truth. And I have found myself in a position, I get invited to this just because I'm a parent. It brings a lot of power to it. And I've had the opportunity to speak around the world. Although I won't fly, I do a lot of TV and radio, but I haven't flown yet. But it's been a great experience for me because I'm an educator. I was a teacher most of my life. And to me, it's all education. And that's what it has to be. We just constantly have to educate, educate, educate. And then maybe people will start participating. And that, to me, is the solution. Okay, thank you very much. I'll move over there.
Oh, okay.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
It's a privilege and an honor for me, again, to share the platform with Cynthia McKinney. And it's been an honor for me to be asked to be a commissioner on this panel. The importance of 9/11 truth cannot be overemphasized. It is impossible to overemphasize the issue of 9/11 truth. Now, the attacks themselves and the false explanations both have been a springboard not only to further criminal agendas by those who wield military and political influence in their bid to maintain a one-way flow of cash and natural resources and labor. And notice I don't make any mention of nation states when it comes to these deep political issues, because a lot of the deep politics transcends the dialectic of nation states. We have to think beyond nation states sometimes. Our foreign policy, to some extent, may be executed through Washington, but it often does not originate there. It's very important for people to understand that when they probe these issues. Now, the false explanations that have been put forth by the mainstream media has, in a very powerful way, intellectually arrested many of not only the American public opinion, but also many peace activist opinion. Their opinions have been arrested. And using 9/11 as a platform for peace activism, while not addressing 9/11 truth, is just purely on the realm of logic completely absurd. The whole Muslims gone bad plus overwhelmed or incompetent intelligence equals 9/11, that just doesn't cut it anymore for anyone with the slightest amount of mental capacity to read the facts as you're going to have them presented to you today. But it's not just presenting the facts, it's not even digesting the facts. As the evidence grows, we need to be psychologically strong enough to face the implications like Bob just mentioned about how deep this can go. As the evidence grows, we have to be completely dissatisfied, and forgive me for using medical lingo, I can't help it, but with incomplete diagnoses, with partial truths, or with just treating or addressing symptoms without trying to root out root causes. Now, any activist working for peace, anyone who claims to be a truth seeker, has to be honest. If you're not going to be honest, then you might as well just get out of the game. At some point, everyone has to ask themselves, well, am I more committed to my role as a spokesperson? Or am I more in love with my soapbox than I am with seeking truth? Am I more satisfied with occupying a niche in the activist scene than I am with seeking the truth? And as a physician, I often ask myself, am I just satisfied treating symptoms and not trying to get at the cure? I just want to draw an analogy for you to really just bring the point home. Say you were a patient of mine and you came to me with a cough, some malaise, not feeling well. I'd advise some rest, maybe some steam inhalation, maybe take a chest x-ray. On the chest x-ray, I might happen to see a little nodule in your lung. Continue to hack away, come back days later, I hear some wheezing. Maybe it's allergy season. I'll give you a little inhaler. How many asthmatics are there out there? Use their inhalers and some anti-allergy medicine. Days later, you come back, you're still hacking, you're still coughing. Except this time, you're bringing a phlegm. Well, then I'll give you a very strong cough suppressant, something that numbs the entire upper airway so you don't really feel the need to cough. And after a while, you're better, and you come back again, coughing, bringing up more phlegm, this time with fevers and chills. Aha, pneumonia. I'll diagnose. It's pneumonia. Give you some antibiotics, give some fluids, and you're better for a while, and then again you come back. This time you're losing weight. You're dehydrated. The fevers continue. Well, no problem. I'll hospitalize you. Give you some IV fluids. I can correct the dehydration. Give you some nutrition. We can even give nutrition through the IV if you're not hungry. A week later, your cough becomes bloody. First, a little bit of blood-tinged mucus, then gobs and gobs of blood. Well, that's okay. I'll transfuse you. I'll just give you blood back through your IV. No problem. Then the nausea, the vomiting, the blurry vision. You can't walk right. The lymph nodes in your neck are golf ball-sized. What's all of this, at this point, you're asking? Well, it's what's called a paraneoplastic syndrome, from cancer that spreads. Now, how absurd is it to just treat symptoms and not diagnose root causes? How absurd it is to treat symptoms of cancer but not even mention the word cancer? Many activists don't even want to go near the 9/11 truth issue. It's completely diagnostically dishonest not to approach this issue. Making partial diagnoses, treating symptoms in the face of obvious signs that there's something much deeper is harmful. It's harmful, and it allows the perpetrative agenda to be unnoticed. So I hope you open your ears and pay attention. I'm going to learn a lot today. I've been following this issue. I've been very supportive of 9/11 truth, and I hope we have a great session. Thank you.
Thank you, commissioners, for your opening statements. I've just been approached backstage by Barry Zellman. Barry's been on my email list, Citizens Watch and unanswerquestions.org, for many months, and I've run into him on a couple of occasions during hearings and so on. And he's asked to make a brief statement. He hasn't prepared anything. He lost his brother Kenneth in the North Tower. And so I'd just like to bring Barry Zellman out for a brief statement to address you. Barry?
Hi, everybody. I kind of dropped by on a kind of short notice. It's kind of an impromptu kind of visit. I didn't plan to come here, so if I stumble and don't make sense, it's because I really didn't plan this. I really was never into politics ever in my life, and it was a rude awakening on my brother's murder 3 years ago. He was my best friend, my only brother. And, you know, these kind of things help me a lot because people understand me. You're a group of captive audience, and it's good. It helps me get through my grief process. There's never a resolution, but it helps. Because most of the time when I talk about dynamics of politics by 9/11, people look at me like I have three heads. Like, what? Bush knew about it? Bush, what are you, crazy? You know, so much for Republicans. And I never wanted to label myself anything. I don't label myself anything. I'm just out there dealing with my brother's murder. And I just wrote this email. People who do know me from the internet. I just write. So I've become a pretty decent writer. But I just responded to Bush families for 9/11, and I'll just read this aloud. It kind of makes sums up a lot of things. When a political party chooses to run its performance of handling its response to 9/11, it had better hope that it can back it up. So many of the surviving 9/11 families know the transparencies in this message. But the Bush administration has always played to its biggest audience, those not directly affected by the mass murder of 2,749 people. Still, to sell this audience on the issue of 9/11, you're walking the dangerous territory. The record speaks of an administration who was not interested in following any of the so many leads in the months preceding 9/11. The August 6th PDB briefing that was publicized was a snapshot of our intelligence. It depicted an Al-Qaeda terrorist group active with cells ready to strike. In fact, your own CIA agency named it Bin Laden determined to strike within the U.S. That was the time to do something. The window of opportunity to intervene and maybe save those lives is gone. Now is not the time to exploit those lives for your own self-serving interests. This was in response to the RNC coming to New York. That's really what it was pertaining to. But I just embrace people that understand that four airplanes, an hour and a half between the first impact and the second impact, with zero military response in the United States, it didn't happen that way. It couldn't have happened that way. You're talking about the most intelligent agencies that we have in the face of your state-of-the-art agencies, and there was zero military response. Why wasn't President Bush on the horn as soon as the second tower was impacted, saying, deploying military to New York? Why? And, you know, I'm a fair person. I listened to all sides of the argument, and I did research upon research upon research, and no one could give me the answer. But it's very transparent because our own president did not want to investigate this tragedy. And I'm standing before you today for one reason. The only thing that I could give my brother is the truth. That's it. I didn't get paid a cent. You know, the money was out there to shut people up. It's a strange dynamic money because there's two sides in 9/11 families. There are ones that were paid and the ones that weren't. And I hate to bring money up, but money is part of the equation. If they were married, the spouses got lots of money. The birth families got nothing. My father, who was 82 years old, my mother still alive. My brother was married. The money went to my brother's wife, and she doesn't even speak to us anymore. That's on a personal level, but the money was there for one reason. It's to keep people, pay them off and keep them quiet. And I thank people like you that are listening. Thank you very much.
Now we're going to move to the first audiovisual portion of our program. I invited members of the Family Steering Committee, which is the group made of principally of women who have been widowed in the wake of 9/11. They lost their husbands. I invited Mindy Kleinberg, but she's now a single mom, and she had things to take care of at home in Jersey. But we do have an edited version, about I think it's about 8.5 minutes, of her testimony, extraordinary testimony, before the 9/11 Commission on March 31st of last year, 2003. Commissioner Gorelick, Jamie Gorelick, one of the 10 commissioners, the Democrat, said after the testimony by the family members that the family members had provided them a roadmap. Why didn't they follow it? So, for now, we'll put on Mindy Kleinberg's testimony last year.
With the United States intelligence agencies, has sophisticated software programs that are used in real time to watch both domestic and overseas markets to seek out trends that may indicate a present or future crime. In the week prior to September 11th, both the SEC and U.S. intelligence agencies ignored one major stock market indicator, one that could have yielded valuable information with regard to the September 11th attacks. On the Chicago Board Options Exchange during the week before September 11th, put options were purchased on American and United Airlines, the two airlines involved in the attacks. The investors who placed these orders were gambling that in the short term, the stock prices of both airlines would plummet. Never before on the Chicago Exchange were such large amounts of United and American Airline options traded. These investors netted a profit of several million dollars after the September 11th attacks. Interestingly, the names of the investors remain undisclosed, and the millions remain unclaimed in the Chicago Exchange account. Why were these aberrant trades not discovered prior to 9/11? Who were the individuals who placed these trades? Have they been investigated? Who was responsible for monitoring these activities? Have those individuals been held responsible for their inaction? I am holding in the hand some of the applications of the terrorists who killed my husband. All of these forms are incomplete and incorrect. Some of the terrorists listed their means of support as simply student, failing to then list the name and address of any school or institution. Others, when asked about their means of support for their stay in the United States, wrote myself and provided no further documentation. Some of the terrorists listed their destination as simply hotel or California or New York. One even listed his destination as no. Had the INS or the State Department followed the law, at least 15 of the hijackers would have been denied visas and would not have been in the United States on September 11, 2001. Prior to 9/11, FAA and Department of Defense manuals gave clear, comprehensive instructions on how to handle everything from minor emergencies to full-blown hijackings. These protocols dictate that in the event of an emergency, the FAA is to notify NORAD. Once that notification takes place, it is then the responsibility of NORAD to scramble fighter jets to intercept the errant plane. It is a matter of routine procedure for fighter jets to intercept commercial airliners in order to regain contact with the pilot. In fact, between June 2000 and September 2001, fighter jets were scrambled 67 times. If that weren't enough protection, on September 11th, NEADS, or the Northeast Air Defense System of NORAD, was several days into a semi-annual exercise known as Vigilant Guardian. This meant that our Northeast Air Defense System was fully staffed. In short, key officers were manning the Operation Battle Center, fighter jets were cocked, loaded, and carrying extra gas on board. Lucky for the terrorists, none of that mattered on September 11th. American Airline Flight 11 departed Boston Logan Airport at 7:45 a.m. The last routine communication between ground control and the plane occurred at 8:13 a.m. Between 8:13 and 8:20, Flight 11 became unresponsive to ground control. Additionally, radar indicated that the plane had deviated from its assigned path of flight. Soon thereafter, transponder contact was lost. Two Flight 11 airline attendants had separately called American Airlines reporting a hijacking, the presence of weapons, and the inflictions of injuries on passengers and crew. At this point, it would seem abundantly clear that Flight 11 was an emergency. And yet, according to NORAD's official timeline, NORAD was not contacted until 20 minutes later at 8:40 a.m. Tragically, the fighter jets were not deployed until 8:52 a.m., a full 32 minutes after loss of contact with Flight 11. Why was there a delay in the FAA notifying NORAD? Why was there a delay in NORAD scrambling fighter jets? How is this possible when NEADS was fully staffed with planes at the ready monitoring our airspace? Flight 175, 77, and 93 all had the same repeat pattern of delays in notification and delays in scrambling fighter jets, delays that are unimaginable considering a plane had, by this time, already hit the World Trade Center. Even more baffling for us is the fact that fighter jets were not scrambled from the closest Air Force bases. For example, for the flight that hit the Pentagon, the jets were scrambled from Langley Air Force in Hampton, Virginia, rather than Andrews Air Force Base right outside D.C. As a result, Washington skies remain wholly unprotected on the morning of September 11th. At 9:41 a.m., 1 hour and 21 minutes after the first plane was hijacked confirmed by NORAD, Flight 77 crashed into the Pentagon. The fighter jets were still miles away. Why? On September 11th, both the FAA and NORAD deviated from standard emergency operating procedures. Who were the people that delayed the notification? Have they been questioned? In addition, the interceptor planes or fighter jets did not fly at their maximum speed. Had the belatedly scrambled fighter jets flown at their maximum speed of engagement, they would have reached New York City and the Pentagon within moments of their deployment, intercept the hijacked airliners before they could have hit their targets, and undoubtedly saved lives. The acting Joint Chief of Staff on September 11th was General Richard B. Myers. On the morning of September 11th, he was having a routine meeting. The acting Joint Chief of Staff stated that he saw a TV report about a plane hitting the World Trade Center, but thought it was a small plane or something like that. So he went ahead with his meeting. Meanwhile, the second World Trade Center was hit by another jet. Nobody informed us of that, Meyer said. By the time he came out of his meeting, the Pentagon had been hit. Whose responsibility was it to relay this emergency to the Joint Chief of Staff? Have they been held accountable for this error? Is it luck that aberrant stock trades were not monitored? Is it luck when 15 of visas are awarded based on incomplete forms? Is it luck when emergency FAA and NORAD protocols are not followed? Is it luck when a national emergency is not reported to top government officials on a timely basis? To me, luck is something that happens once. When you have this repeated pattern of broken protocols, broken laws, broken communication, one cannot still call it luck.
Mindy Kleinberg of the 9/11 Families Steering Committee, testifying before the Kane Commission last year. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests, and this is audio from the 9/11 Citizens Commission. Back to moderator Nick Levice.
Our first witness is Jenna Orkin. And Jenna Orkin is a member of the World Trade Center Environmental Organization, and she's going to be testifying to the air toxicity in Lower Manhattan and the response of the government in the wake of 9/11 relative to the air quality, given the all clear. So Jenna Orkin will give a 15-minute presentation, or up to 15 minutes, and then there'll be Q&A. Actually, then we'll go to John Judge with a staff statement about the 9/11 omission report, and then we'll go to question session. So Jenna Orkin, and we'll now go to a swearing in, which is something the 9/11 Commission did not do early on in its proceedings.
Thanks, Kyle. I'm about to do something that at least I know Condoleezza Rice was running away from. Do you swear to tell the truth before this commission?
Yes.
See, it was so simple.
I want to make sure to get two things in before I start. One is, I am a plaintiff in a potential class action lawsuit against EPA. Two is my website for World Trade Center Environmental Organization, WTCEO.org. September 11th was a tragedy that has changed the course of history and the way we live. It was also an environmental disaster of historic proportions. The way the federal government has handled this aspect of 9/11 has been passive at best. At worst, it rises to a level of reckless endangerment that entails lies stemming from the White House itself. From the beginning, independent scientists and other experts have uncovered data and testified on the dangers of the air downtown. The response of the EPA and via the domino effect of city and state agencies has been contradictory. On the one hand, they protest, "This was unprecedented. What did you expect us to do?" On the other hand, they claim there's no problem. The fact remains that to this day there has been no adequate testing or cleanup, and there are no plans in place for the comprehensive health care that will be necessary to cover the broad spectrum of illnesses, not only respiratory, but also neurological, endocrinological, etc., which will manifest themselves in decades to come. In short, in the environmental aftermath of 9/11, Osama bin Laden could not have found a more felicitous collaborator than George W. Bush. The World Trade Center was a city with its own zip code. It contained approximately 50,000 computers, each made with between 4 and 12 pounds of lead. The first 40 stories of at least one of the towers was coated with hundreds of tons of asbestos, which was pulverized to particles of unusually small size and dispersed around Lower Manhattan, as well as possibly to Brooklyn and beyond. Tens of thousands of fluorescent light bulbs each contained enough mercury to contaminate a quarter of a city block. The smoke detectors contained radioactive americium-241. The U.S. EPA found levels of polychlorinated biphenyls at 75,000 times the previous record. That's my calculation. We can talk later about it. Dioxin also reached record levels. The alkalinity of the air was equivalent to that of drain cleaner. A month after the disaster, scientists from the University of California at Davis found the highest levels of vanadium and other heavy metals and very and ultrafine particles that they had ever recorded out of 7,000 samples taken around the world, including at the burning Kuwaiti oil fields. The EPA did not measure particles of this size. In addition, there were all the other contaminants one might expect to find when a modern city burns. Dr. Marjorie Clark of Hunter College has testified that the World Trade Center disaster was equivalent to dozens of asbestos factories, incinerators, and crematoria, as well as a volcano. Nevertheless, starting on September 13th, the EPA issued reassuring statements about the air quality downtown. At hearings conducted in February and March of 2002, EPA Ombudsman Robert Martin and his chief investigator, Hugh Kaufman, accused EPA Administrator Christy Todd Whitman of lying in part to protect her husband's holdings in Citigroup, the owner of major insurers of Lower Manhattan. The accusation that the EPA had actively lied was recently corroborated by a memo uncovered by EPA scientist Dr. Kate Jenkins, which revealed that at the time of Whitman's statements, EPA already had test results showing asbestos that exceeded the agency's regulation levels. A report by the EPA Inspector General in August of 2003 had said that Whitman's reassurances were premature, but had stopped short of accusing her of lying. However, it revealed that EPA's initial press releases, which cautioned the public about the levels of asbestos in the air and dust, had been revised by the White House Council on Environmental Quality. Cautionary statements about asbestos were deleted and replaced by reassurances. Why did the Council on Environmental Quality interfere in this way? The report stated, the desire to reopen Wall Street played a role in EPA's air quality statements. EPA also made statements about 1% asbestos, and it would be interesting if you asked about that in the Q&A. It was highly deceptive the way they used that standard. EPA was also able to report low readings for certain contaminants by using outdated equipment. An article by Andrew Schneider in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on January 14th of 2002 quotes Dr. Jenkins to the effect that for every asbestos fiber EPA found, independent contractors found 9. The risk of cancer from asbestos could be as high as 1 person in 10. EPA Region 8, which had been in charge of an asbestos cleanup in Libby, Montana, offered Region 2 in New York access to up-to-date equipment. According to Dr. Jenkins' memo of July 4th, 2003, Region 2 replied, "We don't want you fucking cowboys here. The best thing they could do would be assign you to Alaska." With the green light from EPA, Lower Manhattan reopened for residents, offices, and students. Ground Zero workers were often told that since the air was safe, they didn't need to wear respirators. Some, such as Lieutenant Manuel Gomez, were explicitly forbidden to wear a respirator on the grounds that it might frighten the public. Residents returned to their homes, some of which looked like Pompeii. But since EPA had declared the air to be safe, insurance companies often refused to pay for professional abatement. Businesses faced the same dilemma. And since EPA had handed jurisdiction over indoor air to city agencies, residents were obliged to turn to the New York City Department of Health, which recommended that to clean up the dust in their apartments, people use a wet mop or a wet rag. If the dust was really bad, said DOH, they should wear long pants. The Red Cross distributed buckets to assist in what was being portrayed as a piece of mundane, if heavy-duty, house cleaning. DOH also cautioned residents to lower curtains slowly so as to dislodge as little dust as possible, but they said that children and pregnant women need take no extra precautions. Tenants threw out tons of contaminated debris by themselves. Some wore respirators, but were not informed that they were supposed to change the filters, so the respirators were useless after a day or so. On October 9th, Stuyvesant High School, where my son was a student, opened to much fanfare about showing the terrorists. School's chancellor, Harold Levy, set up a bivouac office at the school, telling parents, "If I thought it wasn't safe, would I be here myself?" A fresh woman, whom I shall call Anne, told Levy she was worried and wanted to transfer out at least while the fires burned. Levy said, "If you leave now, you can't come back." 4 days later, Levy himself left, later telling a TV interviewer, "Parents should focus instead on whether their children are having safe sex or wearing seatbelts." In the past 3 years, Anne has had 2 spinal taps to relieve the buildup of fluid pressure in her brain, a condition known as pseudotumor cerebri. For the next 8 months, after October 9th, Stuyvesant, Borough of Manhattan Community College, which was home to 17,000 students, and Independence Plaza, a housing complex of 5,000, got a double whammy of toxic waste. Not only did they have the World Trade Center site to the south, but also at Stuyvesant's north doorstep and next to its ventilation intakes sat the waste transfer barge, which transported the toxic debris to Staten Island. Ordinarily, this placement would have been in violation of state and federal laws, but for the 8 months of cleanup, emergency conditions prevailed. The barge operation also prevented evacuation in the event of another disaster downtown. The kids would have to evacuate south towards it. The barge station, which operated 24/7, played host to a diesel crane and idling diesel trucks, which were only intermittently covered and wetted down as they bore their toxic cargo through the streets. Recently, EPA itself has advocated stronger legislation curtailing diesel emissions, particularly in stationary vehicles, as diesel has been found to contain myriad carcinogens and toxic air contaminants. in part as a result of the barge operation, for half the days until February at the Stuyvesant Monitoring Station, particulate matter 2.5, dust that is small enough to penetrate deep into the lungs and not come out again, was above EPA regulatory levels. Often it was higher at Stuyvesant than at ground zero. Because it has a relatively large surface area to volume ratio, and that's because it's so small, PM 2.5 also adsorbed onto its surface whatever toxic chemicals were in the debris. On occasion, isocyanates and tetrachloroethane and asbestos also exceeded EPA limits, and high levels of lead were found in the gym where the lead could be inhaled deeply and in the cafeteria where it could settle on students' food. Little is known about the synergistic effect of these contaminants, but Dr. Stephen Levin of Mount Sinai has pointed out that if someone is an asbestos worker and a smoker, for instance, the effect is not simply twice as bad as being one or the other, it's 80 or 90 times as bad. A major shield against these pollutants, Stuyvesant's filtration system was approximately 10% effective until the end of January, when at the insistence of the Parents Association, it was upgraded to 40% effectiveness. In addition, after the school reopened, parents and staff learned that in the course of the school's supposed asbestos abatement, the ventilation system had not been cleaned. At this point, the chronology is going to become very simplified. Even after FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, allocated $20 million to clean the Ground Zero schools, the Board of Education refused to clean Stuyvesant's ventilation system or do wipe tests on the grounds that there was no problem. Finally, parents, using the pro bono services of Stuy alumnus and attorney Richard Benveniste of Watergate and now 9/11 Commission fame, threatened to sue. The Board of Ed refused to perform the wipe tests, which showed 30 times the level of lead one might expect to find on the floor. There are no standards for lead in ventilation systems. After initially claiming that the lead would stay in the walls, the Board of Ed finally agreed to clean the ventilation system over the summer. During that cleanup, a group known as Concerned Stuyvesant Community had two segments of the auditorium carpet tested for asbestos using an unusually sensitive test called ultrasonication. The auditorium was the focus of particular concern, as it had been used as a triage center during the weeks that followed 9/11. One of the samples came back with a reading of 2.4 million structures per square centimeter, a level which, according to the independent experts whom Concerned Stuyvesant consulted, indisputably called for remediation. The carpet was replaced, the Board of Ed citing aesthetic reasons. There have been many illnesses. I go into detail. How many minutes? Three. Okay. There have been many illnesses already as a consequence of this exposure. New-onset asthma among residents, over 50% of the Ground Zero workers, a larger number of the firefighters, 14 rescue dogs have died. But let me talk about something else first. In May of 2002, EPA instituted a cleanup program which was dangerously flawed. I won't go into detail unless you want to during the Q&A, except for two things. The normal goal during a cleanup of a Superfund site is 1 in 1 million extra cancers per contaminant. In the case of Lower Manhattan, EPA decided that the best they could shoot for was 1 in 10,000 extra cancers per contaminant. That's 100 times as many cancers as they usually aim for at Superfund sites. The second anomaly in EPA's treatment of Lower Manhattan. They relied on air tests for asbestos, whereas in their own building, they relied on dust tests, which many experts agree are preferable, to determine that their building needed an asbestos abatement. In conclusion, the EPA's handling of 9/11 is not only a catastrophe for New Yorkers, it also bodes ill for the rest of the country, since it serves as a precedent for their response to analogous disasters in the future. As a New Yorker, I'd like to make this final comment. The way the Bush administration has responded to 9/11 strongly suggests that they are very pleased to use New York as a lightning rod to take more than its share of hits, yet get far less than its share of Homeland Security funding. At the same time, President Bush can use future attacks on New York to further his military and other aims. Thank you.
Jenna Orkin of the World Trade Center Environmental Organization. You're listening to audio of the 9/11 Citizens Commission from New York City. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE, Fenner Syracuse, Ithaca Community Radio at 88.1, Free Radio Olympia, and on the web for now, Free Radio Santa Cruz and KFAR, Knoxville. Back to the hearings as Commission Chairperson Cynthia McKinney introduces the next witness.
In pursuit of the truth and in pursuit of information that the powers that be would rather us not have, John Judge's particular expertise is the murder of John F. Kennedy. And as a result of that and my interest in the counterintelligence program, we came together and he gave me information, critical information, in fact, about the murder of Martin Luther King Jr., which is one of my rather intense interests. So with that introduction, John Judge is a stickler for details, and he finds himself now with the unanswered questions of September 11th. So welcome, John.
Thank you. My comments are meant to serve in the role of what would be a staff member to an investigative commission, and that's part of the role that if we can build a truth commission and get public support for it, that 911 Citizens Watch has had as its long-term outcome. So what I'm going to try to do is sort of frame for the commission some of the problems that pertain to this. I'm sure you've seen this. It sold better than Harry Potter recently. And fortunately today, I was glad to see that we have an antidote, which won't sell as well, but this is Paul Thompson's excellent terror timeline and is a much more objective and thorough account of the events of 9/11 than you'll get from this official commission report. One of the questions I had about this is, who is the author? The reason I ask that is that it's written in a very lucid, almost novelist style. It's not a conjunction of reports from other individuals. There's one author here. And we were never told the author of the Warren Commission report either. I dug it out of the record. He was brought over from the Pentagon, Army Historical Division, on a technical duty order to write the report. And when the report was handed back to those investigative teams, they wrote extensive notes saying, what's his basis for this? How does he reach this conclusion? All those were buried for many years. His name was Otto Winokur. He was brought here by General MacArthur at the end of the war. He was one of 26 official historians for Hitler's Reich. And the author of the Star report about the Clinton scandal with Monica had been a previous writer for Penthouse magazine. I actually sent Tipper Gore a note asking her to put one of her obscene stickers on the report. So we don't know who the real author is here, but it is a bestseller. It's still seen as the definitive account. There's very little public criticism of it. It came out of a flawed commission process that we addressed in a critique that we released the day that it was released, and there's some copies of that available here. In addition, we couldn't do the autopsy till the corpse hit the ground, but it's still kicking. Two monographs have appeared, staff statements since this came out, and a chronology is promised, and there is ongoing congressional testimony as well. There, in the monographs, there was an interesting disclaimer on each by Philip Zelikow, the former executive director of the commission, saying that the commission had access to these monographs in both draft and final form and in both classified and unclassified forms.